Good morning. I've spent a great deal of time writing about big cats over the last years and observing them in the wild. I just returned from South Africa, and the highlight of that trip was that I spent 10 days with a leopard family, watching 2 4-month-old female cubs, this is one of them, learn how to climb trees, learning how to properly gnaw on the carcass that their mother hunted for them, nursing, playing. But it was really sad to get so emotionally involved with these like really cute little animals, because even if they make it into adulthood, and 80% of cubs don't survive their first year, they're in great danger. Leopards are getting hammered in South Africa. There's a huge demand for skins from members of the Shembe Baptist Church. They wear leopard skin capes in religious ceremonies that blend traditional Zulu customs with elements of Old Testament Christianity. So as I watched these adorable cubs, I wondered whether they'd survive long enough to breed. Leopards, along with most wild cats, are disappearing. They face a litany of threats that often overlap and combine in ways that heighten the consequences, and that's even without factoring in climate change. But few of the issues we'll raise today during this panel session pertain just to big cats. These same threats are decimating wildlife across the planet. As we watch even the most magnificent species disappear, snow leopards, tigers, elephants, whales, bears, so many more, it begs the question, if we can't save our most charismatic species, what can we save? If we can't save lions, how do we save a nondescript fish species or a poisonous snake or a small tan toad? But today we'll look at big cats as a case study, delving into the reasons behind their decline and discussing what is being done and what needs to be done to save them. I'll be wearing 2 hats here since one of our panelists, Kristen Knoll, had to cancel last minute due to illness. I don't know if I should share this, but I think I have to. She has hoof and mouth disease, and she's in quarantine. That's just too great a story to not share. Maybe it's TMI, but it's just great. So I'll start us off with an overview. We'll then hear from Judy Mills, a former journalist who's an authority on the geopolitics underlying the endangered species trade and author of the forthcoming book, Blood of the Tiger, A Story of Conspiracy, Greed, and the Battle to Save a Magnificent Species. She headed TRAFIC's East Asia office, guided the World Wildlife Fund's global strategy for saving wild tigers, worked for Conservation International and at Save the Tiger Fund, and founded and led the International Tiger Coalition. Then we'll bring things closer to home, and we'll hear about the Florida panther from wildlife zoologist Lori McDonald. She directs the Defenders of Wildlife's Florida program and is the conservation group representative on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Florida Panther Recovery Implementation Team. She also serves as a board member for the National Endangered Species Coalition and the Everglades Law Center. And we'll take questions after the presentations. Okay, so let's begin. Habitat loss is a huge problem. Our exploding human population is leveling the jungles and forests where big cats live. As we plant farms and plantations, build communities and factories and infrastructure, these animals are squeezed into ever smaller areas and are often trapped in these scraps of habitat by things like huge open pit mines, by railroad lines, by roads. When young cats disperse to find their own territory, or cats roam to hunt or find a mate, they're in great danger. And these small isolated populations become inbred over time, making them weak and susceptible to hereditary disease. The Florida panther is the poster child for this, poster animal, for this issue, and we'll hear more about this from Lori shortly. So once roads cut into wilderness, statistics show how hunting rises exponentially. People come in with guns and snares, hunting the same animals for food that big cats eat, deer, antelope, wild boar. In Asia, many areas have become so-called empty forests. Okay, so we have forests with no prey, and with farms literally on the border of wildlife reserves, of course there's conflict. Hungry cats or old or injured animals or a mom with cubs sometimes kill livestock. They're easy pickings, whether it's a jaguar killing cattle, tigers killing water buffalo, or snow leopards killing yak. Losing an animal that provides milk or meat can pose a huge economic hardship, and villagers often retaliate by killing the suspect. This jaguar was supposedly a cattle killer on a ranch in the Brazilian Pantanal. These 12 jaguars had been killed in the previous 12 months, again, all supposed cattle killers. Poachers also have cats in the crosshairs, with pelts, bones, and other parts commanding a small fortune on the black market. This demand could be the death knell for tigers, for leopards, lions, snow leopards, as well as other animals like elephants and rhinos. Judy will share decades of insight into tiger poaching and the illegal international wildlife trade. There's little deterrent in most countries. Though police and customs agents make some arrests and seizures, penalties are light. Few poachers or smugglers see jail time. In India, which is home to half the world's remaining wild tigers, there's a 3% conviction rate for wildlife crime. Most governments view wildlife crime as an environmental issue, and it's low on the list of priorities. That is changing a little bit. There have been some huge global forums in the recent year or two where governments are coming together and looking at wildlife crime as the huge international problem it is. But these cats were hunted for centuries before the current poaching crisis, which kicked in during the 1980s. The Mughals in present-day India, for example, staged trophy hunts for tigers as far back as the 16th century, a tradition that was continued on steroids by Indian and British nobility. Kings and maharajas often drugged and baited their trophies before a shoot, so hunters were in little danger, and they'd definitely come back with a tiger. Historian Mahesh Rangarajan writes that, quote, over 80,000 tigers were slaughtered in 50 years from 1875 to 1925. It is possible that this was only a fraction of the numbers actually slain. Later, maharajas created staggering new hunting records. The Maharaja of Udaipur reportedly took down 1,000 tigers in hunts up until 1965. This kind of trophy hunt ended when the Delhi High Court banned tiger killing in 1971. But in some countries, over the course of the 20th century, countries including India and China, tigers were systematically exterminated. In the late 1950s, as part of the People's Republic of China's Great Leap Forward, Mao Zedong declared the cats to be one of the four pests that threatened progress, and his eradication programs killed three-quarters of the country's South Chinese tigers within a few years. Then the 1960s fashion craze for fur, like fur coats, fashion, U.S., Europe, took down cats across the globe. When Rudyard Kipling penned The Jungle Book at the turn of the 20th century, about 100,000 tigers roamed 30 nations across Asia. Today, about 3,000 wild tigers hang on in 13 countries. There's some question whether two countries still have any at all. It may be 11 countries. They're gone from 93% of their former range. They're the most endangered big cat, despite the fact that year after year, in polls conducted by Animal Planet, they rank as the world's most popular animal, beating out the family dog. And they've had more money spent trying to save them than any other creature on Earth. One important note here: a captive raves tiger has never been successfully reintroduced to the wild, because if they're habituated to people, they're dangerous. And you can't just plop them into a forest, because they're extremely territorial animals and they'll fight to the death over turf. There's been some situations where researchers tried to introduce a female for breeding. The resident female was killed, and there was no tigers born for the next 3 years. So people don't realize that there's so few tigers left, because there's so many tigers in zoos and, you know, tiger farms in China. And so they figure tigers are okay, but that's not the case. But the reality of living with predators is that they wander outside park boundaries, and they sometimes kill people. 2 years ago, I traveled to India's Bandhavgarh National Park. One day, a tigress wandered into a village that bordered the reserve. She was followed by her three huge, almost grown cubs. The park director sent three men on elephants to herd them back. The tigress was visibly stressed. I was maybe 100 yards away in a jeep when she encountered a villager walking through a field. With one swipe, she killed him. It was a horrific confluence of factors, tigers with too little space and bad park management. I attended the cremation. It was the brother of a park guard we knew. And the experience brought home in a very real way how difficult it is to live side by side with tigers and any dangerous predator. And it raised the question of how do we protect both people and tigers, which is a wide-ranging cat, in an increasingly crowded world. The balance between wildlife and humans is always delicate. The only way to really protect tigers is to make sure that there are some real benefit for those that live beside them. In India, the government has moved hundreds of villages from inside tiger reserves, and they give families a choice of either cash or land to move. Relocations that were well planned gave villagers greater safety, they had better access to schools, to medical care, and, you know, decent land to farm. But not all of these relocations were planned out well, and some of them were really a disaster. Anyway, there's a plan to continue to relocate hundreds of villages that are in and around India's tiger reserves. But some programs launched by NGOs offer other kinds of economic incentives to protect cats. These initiatives often, you know, offset livestock losses, and some have been really successful. In a number of villages in northeast Pakistan, women are taught to make handicrafts, which are sold in the U.S., as long as they adhere to an agreement to not kill snow leopards. When the biologist who started this program visits, he's treated like a rock star. The village has made enough money through this initiative to buy a computer for their school, hire an extra teacher, and start adult education classes for themselves in the evenings. NGOs were also vaccinating their yaks and goats. They used to lose 25 to 30% of their animals every year to disease. In Ladakh, NGOs are building predator-proof corrals to protect yaks and goats from snow leopards. And some families in India make money through a Himalayan homestays program, hosting trekkers in their homes during the summer months. In many instances, this is the only hard currency they make. They mostly use a barter system. And in the Brazilian Pantanal, where over 90% of the land is privately owned, jaguars are rebounding. The ranchers have discovered that eco-tourist dollars more than account for the occasional lost cow. Snow leopards have become a huge economic positive for, you know, whole areas, and people really work hard to protect them. And, you know, jaguars, again, ecotourism. Tiger tourism brings in cash to areas with tiger reserves and helps keep extra eyes on tigers, and which is really great because the poaching crisis is so intense. There's other success stories. In the Nai Kak Hang Wildlife Sanctuary in Thailand was overrun by poachers, and it was nearly an empty forest. There was almost nothing left alive. But with long-term scientific research providing data for innovative enforcement, it's now home to about 60 breeding tigers, with another 150 in nearby wilderness that stretches all the way to the Myanmar border. Their smart patrol and an elite military-style force combines roving foot patrols with digitally mapped field intelligence data to monitor threats and strategize enforcement. Here, they get firearms training from Thai police and military advisors. The places where wildlife is thriving all have serious protection, like Kaziranga National Park in Assam, India, where about 350 armed guards protect the park from waves of poachers that are actually mostly after the rhinos, which, ironically, the rhinos protect the tigers in that way. But this armed force... it's like the Wild West. There's shootouts all the time, like poachers that have AK-47s. But This park is now home to the highest density of tigers in the world. It's an important reminder that parks need protection for the same reason that cities need police. As field biologist George Schaller notes, saving the top predators has wider implications, including huge human benefits, which is an important factor that we as journalists need to explore. If we preserve the remaining big tracts of forest, wetlands, and jungle that big cats need to survive, we're giving them space to hunt, to find a mate, and enough land to survive catastrophic events like floods or drought. These forests provide buffer from flooding, protecting towns and cities, and preventing erosion of the soil that we need to grow crops. Forests purify the rivers and streams that run through them, the watersheds that provide drinking water for millions of people. Without top predators, ecosystems unravel. But by protecting them, we also save the entire spectrum of life that shares their realm, preserving ecosystems that have been fine-tuned over millennia. So one answer to the question that we pose here, if we can't save charismatic big cats, what can we save? Is that if we save big cats, we're saving many more species at the same time. So now let's focus in on a particular threat, the wildlife trade. I'd like to introduce Judy Mills. She'll step up here.
Great. Good morning. And Sharon, amazing pictures. Incredible.
Those photographs are almost all by National Geographic photographer Steve Winter.
Sharon talked about these magnificent creatures in the wild, and unfortunately I have the task of talking about them in bits and pieces. Specifically, I'm going to talk about tiger consumption and trade, but what I'm about to say applies to many species of cats and also other animals, and I'll touch on that briefly. But let me start by asking you, how many of you think that consumers buy tiger bone wine as medicine? How about as an aphrodisiac? Anyone? Interesting, okay. Status symbol? How about as a financial investment, along with stocks and bonds? Thank you for participating in that. A lot of people are surprised to find out that consumers of tiger bone wine today mainly are buying tiger bone wine for the latter two purposes. The use of tiger bone wine in traditional Chinese medicine has waned, and the latter two purposes are on the rise. And in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of many of my peers, this is probably the single greatest threat to the survival of wild tigers today. Oh, yes. Tiger bone wine is made usually with some sort of rice wine, and which is put in a vat, and a whole tiger skeleton is then placed in that vat, and the price of the wine goes up the longer the bones, the skeleton, steeps in that wine. And in some cases, for very, very expensive wine, a bit of ground-up tiger bone will be put into the wine. Anyway, this is one of 400 bottles of tiger bone wine that were offered at auction in Beijing in 2011. The opening bids were set as high as $32,000 a case. China's State Forestry Administration stopped the sale at the last minute because, indeed, it was illegal. But that was only thanks to the coverage of Jonathan Watts at The Guardian and also efforts by the International Fund for Animal Welfare. So today I'm going to talk to you about why tiger trade is about luxury and profit, and it is not about health and tradition or culture. I'm going to talk about why the lead players are no longer traditional Chinese medicine users, but entrepreneurs and organized criminals hoping to bank on extinction in collusion with government and military officials. I'll talk about why there are two times as many tigers on farms in China as there are left in the wild. And this is despite China's 1993 ban on tiger trade. and I will tell you why tiger farming threatens the survival of wild tigers. I'll talk about how one law in particular is abetting tiger trafficking and stimulating demand for tiger products. And finally, I'm going to talk about why stopping commodification of tigers and other species may rest with you, awakening the world to what is about to become a done deal. This is a Wall Street Journal article that ran in 2012. It's about a new asset class for wealthy Chinese. It affects tigers, but also rhinos and elephants and a long list of other species that are now worth far more dead than alive. An economist friend of mine, who actually supports tiger trade, calls rhino horn, quote, an analog to gold, and tiger bone wine, quote, the Johnny Walker Blue of Chinese health tonics. So how did we come to this? In the early 1990s, China was down to a handful of tigers because of the reasons Sharon talked about, because of the price on their head, but also because for centuries, China had used tiger bones in medicine. It was at that point that Chinese started looking to other countries for tiger bone, and the traditional Chinese medicine industry became the main driver of poaching, surpassing the demand for skins. Also in 1993, bowing to international pressure, including the threat of trade sanctions from the United States, China banned domestic trade in both tiger bone and rhino horn. They removed both ingredients from their official pharmacopoeia. All medicine manufacturing with these ingredients was stopped, and the buying and selling of both of these things became a crime. The traditional Chinese medicine community was shocked, blindsided. They were reluctant to comply. That's about the time I started in my position at Traffic East Asia, based in Hong Kong. And what we did there was we started to work with the traditional Chinese medicine community to explain to them, or at least try to find some common ground and enlist them in tiger conservation, because we knew if we didn't have them on our side, that the laws would never work. They would just continue the trade as the drug trade continues illegally and in secret. It was rough going at first, but then they saw the wisdom of it, because the traditional Chinese medicine community wants to sell their medicine system and their medicines to the world. And they realized that they were never going to be able to market their medicines in the United States, in Canada, in Europe, and in Australia if they included endangered species. So they saw the business sense of it. And as a result of that, they themselves conducted campaigns against tiger trade in the United States, Canada, Australia, Europe, and eventually in China. It was just an amazing thing to watch, and I thought, and I and others in the conservation community thought, all right, you know, CITES bans international trade. CITES, the UN Treaty on Trade in Endangered Species, bans international trade, and there were domestic trades in place, not just in China, but in the other former major markets in Asia. So we thought, mission accomplished, and we were high-fiving. And you know how dangerous that is. What a mistake. One of my major regrets. At that time, China had one farm with less than 100 tigers. And many people, including myself, thought tiger farming was nipped in the bud, that it ended before it even really got a start. Unfortunately, in secret, we later found out that numbers were beginning to rise. In 1999... there were 600 tigers on farms. Soon there were 1,000, and then 2,000. And by 2007, the State Forestry Administration of China reported that there were 5,000 tigers on 200 farms. We found out only recently, I mean within the last couple of years, that around 2005, the State Forestry Administration of China secretly licensed some of these farms to make tiger bone wine and sell it. The State Forestry Administration even helped finance the building of one of the wineries. At the same time, other businesses were secretly permitted to sell tiger skins. As many times as NGOs and journalists and CITES called out the problem, the State Forestry Administration refused to confirm or deny that tiger trade was quietly and slowly reopening. Wine production increased. And with all of that, with these tiger farms visible to all in China and some of these products starting to seep into the market, and as Chinese grew more and more affluent, many more of them began seeking tiger skins as home decor. They wanted tiger bone wine. They even wanted live tiger banquets where tigers were killed in front of them so that they could eat the meat. And those who wanted the very best wanted tigers from the wild, because the tenets of Chinese medicine say that wild is better. And we've done surveys in China which have documented that the vast majority of people believe that the wild are better, and they will pay exponentially more for wild tigers than they will for farmed. And the most chilling fact of all, and this also is something that the conservation community has just finally grasped, China's wildlife protection law, yes, their wildlife protection law, mandates the domestication and consumption of tigers. The ban in 1993 did not supersede this law's mandate to farm and consume not just tigers, but a list of 53 other endangered species. Meanwhile, China's stock market dropped, its real estate market softened, and gold prices slumped. Hence, a uniquely Chinese asset class was born. And what would increase those assets more than anything else? Extinction would make them priceless. Many people are now banking on extinction. This is a picture taken at China's largest tiger farm. This farm is also licensed to make and sell tiger bone wine. Jonathan Watts at The Guardian described them, these tigers, as raised like battery hens. And it's true. The farm uses speed breeding. The cubs are taken from their mother early so that the mothers can breed again. Sometimes the babies are suckled on dogs and pigs so that they can grow while their mother is again reproducing. No different than cows and pigs. There are now, according to the State Forestry Administration in China, 6,000 tigers on farms, perhaps more. There are only, as Sharon said, perhaps 3,000 now in the wild. There are two times as many tigers on farms in China as there are in the wild. And there are a handful of rogue conservationists and economists who've been recruited by the State Forestry Administration to tout tiger farming. You may have seen them in the New York Times and in other publications. They say that you have to sell tigers to save them. They argue in very soundbite-friendly bits and pieces that it's the only way to save them. But their arguments are flawed, and the economics of it simply don't hold up. And I'm going to tell you why now, just a few reasons why tiger farming leads to more poaching of wild tigers and has put tigers in dire danger. Probably, you know, there could be overnight catastrophic extinction if this thing goes the wrong way. One of the reasons that tiger farming is so dangerous is that it recruits more users, millions of users. Just in China alone, there are 1.4 billion people, and most of them know that tiger bone wine is a good thing. It's part of Chinese tradition to know that. Many of them have not been consuming because it's illegal, or it was illegal, and now it's quasi-legal, and so more and more of them are consuming. And some of those will be wealthy enough to want and afford the best, the rarest, something that only money can buy, and those will be the wild ones. And if just a tiny fraction of China's 1.4 billion people want to have parts and products of wild tigers, it will be a disaster. Another factor is that tigers live in the poorest regions of Asia, as Sharon was talking about. Poaching a tiger, just one tiger, can be a windfall for an Indian poacher who's supporting a family on $1 a day. So the incentive to poach is huge. Another factor that is that it can cost as little as $10 to poach a tiger. It takes $10 a day to feed a tiger on a farm. So the wild tigers bring premium prices on the black market with almost no cost to production. And the economic gains in poaching, smuggling, and traffic offer excellent profits for every change of hands from forest to end user. Finally, this slowly opening legal trade in China of farmed products is a fantastic cover for illegal trade, for laundering. And it is impossible for law enforcement to distinguish the parts and products of farm tigers from those of wild. So law enforcement is impossible. Farms in China are readying to launch a multi-billion dollar a year business to supply tiger products to China and then to Asia and perhaps the world. They've already set up distribution networks. Hedging their bets, people, entrepreneurs in Thailand, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and Indonesia are also starting tiger farming. At the same time, demand is up for lion bone, leopard bone, and the bones of other wild cats. China recently started farming rhinos, sending the signal that the market for rhino horn will soon reopen. And we all know what that's led to. As we sit here today, there's an ongoing slaughter in Africa of rhinos for their horns to feed the Chinese market. And their list of 51 other species besides tigers, rhinos, and bears that are slated for the same fate, to be farmed, to be commodified. In this chart, you can see that in 1993, there were nearly 8,000 wild tigers versus less than 100 on that single tiger farm in China. By 2007, their numbers were equal. Now there are 6,000 on farms with the stated aim of there being 100,000. Meanwhile, the wild stand at a shaky 3,000. When I was a young journalist in 1991 in China for the first time, trying to see bears milked of their bile on China's bear farms, and while my minders were trying to prevent me from seeing that very thing, they took me to a fur farm, and that fur farm happened to be China's first tiger farm. I will never forget the moment when one of my minders told me that there were already 6,000 bears on bio farms. That was in 1991. No one was writing about or talking about this at that time. I thought, how on earth could this have happened while the world knew nothing about it? And then my chief minder said to me their goal was to have 40,000 bears on farms. He said, we plan to farm them like cows and pigs. And then I came to understand that they planned the same thing for tigers and then rhinos. And you see, and we now all see what that's stimulating in Africa. And that's why this became the story that I couldn't let go of. So why can't CITES stop this? Nearly every country in the world now belongs to CITES, so why can't they stop it? First of all, CITES is an international treaty. It made a decision in 2007 that tiger farming should stop. By consensus, it decided it should stop. Tiger farms should be phased out. But unfortunately, that does not fall within the purview of the articles of the treaty, and therefore it's only a recommendation, a decision, an ask. It is not a law. China, of course, is ever more powerful at CITES. With China's rise to superpower status and its ubiquitous economic tentacles all over the world, there's less and less pushback against China now on these issues. In fact, at the last CITES meeting, no one even breathed the phrase tiger farming. Not one person had the gall or the guts to raise it on the floor, even though this 2007 decision by CITES has been ignored. The United States, which was once, you know, a major factor for stepping in, including that threat of trade sanctions back in 1993 because of China's trade in tiger bone and rhino horn, is now losing ground at CITES because The United States has dirty tiger secrets of its own. I'm only going to mention this in passing, but I will say that in the United States, we have as many or more captive tigers as China does. And China is starting to ask, why should we get rid of our captive tigers if the United States isn't getting rid of its captive tigers? So what can be done? I think the number one thing that can be done and must be done is to change China's wildlife protection law. If I had known in 1993 what I know now, I would have dedicated my life to doing that. I did not know, but now that I know, there are many people working on it, and the good news is there are many Chinese working on it within China. Chinese NGOs are taking this up. They're making some progress. Unfortunately, the State Forestry Administration is blocking them at every turn. So I think it's very, very important that we expose this conspiracy. My book was written to expose this conspiracy, but others need to speak up. We need to unmask those who are banking on extinction. Some of these people are very powerful people. We need to expose them. We need to question why there is no enforcement of the CITES decision against tiger farming. Why there's no enforcement in China or the U.S. I think it's important to ask both questions. And I think we need to awaken the world to the end game, which is in play right now. In 2016, South Africa will ask for permission from CITES to trade rhino horns with China. They want to send their rhino horns to China. In order for China to receive those rhino horns and to trade them, they will need to lift their 1993 ban. Their 1993 ban is on the trade of rhino horn and tiger bone. If they do that, tiger trade will be fully reopened, as will the trade in rhino horn, and I will predict that wild rhinos and wild tigers will not be long for this world. So it all comes down to you and people like you. If the eyes of the world are not watching this, commodification of these animals will be a fait accompli, and it will happen quickly. The treaties of the governments and the NGOs who were once the watchdogs of this issue are in an untenable geopolitical spot. They mainly deal with the issue at CITES, and the State Forestry Administration is the face of China there, and they have made severe threats against all of these governments and NGOs who try to push back. And as a consequence of that, nobody's talking. It reminds me of Stepford, the Stepford Wives. It's scary. It's unbelievable, really. Anyway, as I said, NGOs in China are on the job, but they tread on a knife's edge, as you know. There's only so much they can do. So you may be in the most important position to stop tigers and rhinos and lions and fill in the blank other species from becoming like cows and pigs. So please do all you can while there's still time.
Thank you, Judy.
Wow. Let's bring this discussion local with a cat whose historical range once included Louisiana, the Florida panther. Lori?
Thank you for the talks that have gone ahead. Let's see. I'll use the, well.
Do I need to use the microphone?
Yes.
All right. I'm really grateful to have this opportunity to talk about the Florida panther and bring the story of this animal's plight and perhaps hopefulness to you so that in turn, I hope, of course, that you will want to cover the story of the panther and bring education to people, bring a message that is hopeful about the possibility of saving this endangered subspecies of puma. And in fact, let me say right off the bat that The panther is a subspecies that is part of the species of puma that include mountain lion, cougar, painter, catamount. They go by a number of names. But the Florida panther, like this, the Florida panther is highly endangered. It was put on the U.S. Endangered Species Act when that act was first adopted in 1973. And in fact, in the 1970s is when they went out to actually search in South Florida to find out whether or not this animal even existed anymore. They found, they estimated around a dozen to maybe 20 animals they thought were there. When I started doing conservation work in the 80s, the prediction really was that the Florida subspecies would be gone, would be extinct within about 25 to 40 years. But here we are, 35 years later, and there are today an estimated number of about 100 to 180 adults and sub-adults. This is really hopeful news that there could be, you know, close to 200 animals there. And yet when you think about that in the scheme of things, 200 of this entire subspecies, a small number, but at least it's growing. And you see that I put up the genetic reinvigoration program in 1995. This program, which was carried out by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, is what really has prompted the change in the population, the growth in the population of Florida panthers, along with, of course, better regulation, better enforcement, better habitat protection, which ultimately are so very important. But the inbreeding at that time had resulted in heart dysfunction, in reproductive problems for the animal. The young were, for a while people thought, oh, it's got a little, like a little crooked tail at the end, and it has a little thing on the nape of its neck, and those seemed to be just outward physical manifestation. But when it was discovered how serious this was with regard to reproduction and heart problems and so forth, it was known that something had to be done to solve the inbreeding problem. And several Texas cougar females were brought to South Florida and put into the remaining population. And the first generation, the first offspring, showed no signs of these dysfunctions or these congenital problems. And the population began to grow. Now, again, it's combined with many other things, but that really was a turning point. And I should say that the Texas cougar and the Florida panther would have historically been interbreeding at the margins of their areas. It wasn't like bringing in a totally different animal to breed. So you see that this is kind of a chart that's used by the Florida Wildlife Commission to kind of show once upon a time there were, I don't know if you can see it or not, there are five panthers in that upper picture. The female with four young, that's a high number. They were persecuted, they were overexploited, people tried to get rid of them, they became quite rare, they became isolated because of habitat loss, but now there's been a rebounding to the point where now we have conflict situations between the panther and with human beings. So I want to show you what their original range was and what it is today. The Florida panther, again, it's kind of misleading to say Florida panther because it roamed all the way from Arkansas to Louisiana, Georgia, into Florida. It was throughout the southeastern U.S. But today, just in that small portion of its range at the very southern tip of Florida. However, the recovery plan for the panther, which the agencies, many NGOs, like my own organization, Defenders of Wildlife, and others, are working very hard to try and implement. Through that work, research has been done to survey where could there be recipient sites, areas where panthers could roam again. What areas have large enough large enough, sizable enough acreage, have a few roads, few people, and have the prey base of deer. And you can see here, there are several that have been identified throughout the southeast that could be recipient sites for the panther. I also want to point out something else on this slide, and that is this little diamond shape right here. That represents a pretty inspiring, hopeful thing. The Florida panther that was identified in Georgia, well into Georgia, its parentage is from the big cypress area down here. And that animal moved all the way up through Florida, through Georgia, and into Georgia where it was settling in. Unfortunately, the reason we know that is that it was shot, and a DNA analysis was done. But at least we know they can make it. This is a problem in Florida, and I'm going to concentrate mostly on the state of Florida because that's where the panthers are now. This is the Everglades, or it was the Everglades, and kind of represents that we are trying to recover a large carnivore, scary to people, needs a lot of area in a very urbanizing state. It is pretty amazing that South Florida, in the big cypress Everglades system and all that, still has animals like a panther and bear and crocodiles and mink. And all, I mean, just it's kind of amazing what is there today. And there are still big spaces. So even though the projection is that, as you see today, if you look for these at these two maps, the one on the right has a whole lot more of that developed land. That's a moderate prediction for the future. Pretty hard to be still saving more big spaces and linkages between them. I put some of this up because I think in your work, you may be interested in knowing what kind of data is available to you as you research your stories. And Florida has an incredibly good database of information. When we go from the idea of loss of habitat and in this developing state to looking at loss of habitat from the kind of like from the outside, I need to bring up, of course, the question of climate change and sea level rise. The Gulf Coast, Florida, are globally known to be vulnerable spots for climate change and sea level rise. And it's not just that habitat may be lost from submerged land or saltwater intrusion and so forth. It's that people are going to move, and people are going to move even more into habitat that would be used by panthers and the linkage areas between those, hopefully those large areas of habitat that can be saved. So sea level rise, climate change is a factor for them. Let's see if I can get that in. I also want to make the point that for recovery of the Florida panther, which is described as three wild populations, self-sustaining wild populations, and you saw where possible recipient sites are. Well, the way that's going to happen, the easiest, if it's going to happen, is if the panther can return on its own. And that means, of course, linkages between large habitat areas and tolerance by people of having them on the landscape. So those are the three things I want to concentrate on: saving core habitat, connectivity, and coexistence. Coexistence being the human-wildlife interaction. Conservation of core and corridor habitat, that's big landscape level protection, is what's going to save this animal. And that will require not just public lands and, you know, parks and forests that are in the public hands, public trust, but private lands. And there are conflicts occurring on private lands, but there are also programs that we're trying to put in place that will help the private landowner. One of the most important stories in Florida right now is a ballot measure that will come up on voting day, November 4th. It's called Amendment 1, Florida's Water and Land Legacy, a state constitutional amendment. And this amendment, if passed, will will provide funding again for Florida's land acquisition program, for conservation easements, for restoration measures, and for management of conservation areas. So it's a big deal for those of us in Florida. It's a historic vote, and if Florida's in your sights, hope that you'll cover a story on this. It's, the polls are looking good, but we cannot feel confident yet, not until the vote takes place. Another, so that's kind of at the state level and the individual level of a person being able to vote. This I wanted to show you quickly is a national level program. When Secretary Salazar for Department of Interior was there, he started the America's Great Outdoors program and declared a really quite a large initiative, a partnership initiative to establish or expand 3 wildlife refuges in South Florida. So these kinds of measures are really important too. Where's the funding though? It's the funding. Where are we going to find it? This measure provides for both public land and private land protection. So a little more connectivity. Beautiful panther. Will it make it across the road? Not all of them do. And vehicle mortality is the major direct cause of panther death. Because of habitat limitations, they've reached carrying capacity in its South Florida habitat. The other major source of mortality is what we call intraspecific aggression. That's panthers killing panthers. They are habitat limited. The wildlife crossings that have been put in and some of the other fixes for this have made quite a difference. They truly are a lifesaver for panthers and for other species too, other wide-ranging species like Florida black bear and even alligators and other species will use the wildlife crossings. I said that the animals are habitat limited now. As you can see from this map that shows distribution points, telemetry points for panthers, and these are roadkill, the blue are telemetry points. There's a river here, Caloosahatchee River, and you'll see there were very few marks above here. In fact, a lot of these blue marks are really from just a couple of animals, sightings of a couple of animals. And that Caloosahatchee River is a bit of a barrier to them. In fact, only males so far have gone across. And without females moving into Central and North Florida and beyond, there will not be panther population above there. So both male and females need to move. I'm trying to show, some of them do, as I said, some young males have moved out and gone ahead forward. And
we're gonna have time for questions.
Okay. And so I'm going to bring this back to saying that there have been a couple of, there's been a female with 2 young very close to the river. This area has been protected, this last remaining natural connection across the river. But if we don't have like wildlife crossings in here, we fear that she and others that may make it up to there would be killed first on the roads. So there are a number of propositions for where wildlife corridors can exist, and a lot of people working on that. Now, the coexistence challenges, this is the human wildlife dynamic of in which we're trying to assure that people will, again, live with this large carnivore across the landscape, but it is not an easy matter sometimes. Proactive solutions, incentives for private landowners, payments for ecological services. These programs are being worked on as we speak. Our Panther recovery team has a proposal that we're now going out for funding for so that private landowners will want to protect panther habitat. There's also the reactive kind of work. My organization, Defenders, has been pioneered some of the livestock compensation programs, but we're now trying to get into the proactive rather than the reactive kinds of work. The animals are showing up where you would not expect, and problems result. People want them gone. People are afraid. They're worried that people will be hurt directly by them, and one could never say that wouldn't happen. It is possible. And so it's really important to work on these protective measures. Protect people, pets, livestock, and panthers all. This is one of the programs we do. We help people to build livestock pens. That brochure on the bottom there is in the back. Partnerships are absolutely integral to making these things work. In my career, it seems to me, I've noticed that while the politics have gotten, people are on such extreme, different sides when it comes to political maneuvering, it seems to me also, though, that in our discussions between business, industry, conservation, NGOs, agencies, there is so much more sitting around the table talking with each other now and solutions trying to be worked out that I find that a really positive thing. A very positive thing. So, a couple stories. Amendment 1, the state constitutional amendment. The Florida Wildlife Corridor Expedition, which is, two years ago, four people accompanied along the way occasionally by others, such as myself, went 1,000 miles in 100 days from the Everglades to the Georgia border to show a wildlife corridor can exist. And they are taking off next month to do 700 miles in 70 days across the Florida Panhandle, with opportunities every day, actually, for watching that. And I have to put in a plug for the Florida Panther Festival coming up on November 15th. This is one of those kind of cheerful ways of working on conservation and trying to educate the community and learn from them also on how to protect panthers and other wildlife. And so thank you very much for listening, and we look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
Obviously, saving big cats is a very difficult set of issues. I just would like to hear any kind of questions you have for any of our panelists. We have a few minutes before lunch.
Yeah, I'm Tom Henry at the Toledo Blade. Judy, I was real fascinated. I hadn't really heard much about the tiger farms before, and I was wondering if you... You made a reference to the U.S. having as many captives as China. Are those mostly captive tigers in zoos? And also, is there any scenario, just trying to be an optimist here, knowing how corruption and economics and finances often overweigh things, but is there any possibility of tiger farms being used in a positive way, such as trying to, you know, captively rebuild the population without, you know, using it for, you know, for tiger bone wine?
Wait, can you repeat the first part of your question?
I'm sorry. The first part of the question was the comparison of U.S. and China, our captive tigers versus theirs.
Yes, thank you for asking. And I had to mention that. I'm sorry I just mentioned it in passing, but yes, they're in the hands of zoos, of course, which, you know, conservationists don't have a problem with. But actually, to maintain the genetic integrity and natural history of tigers, you know, we only need very few tigers in zoos. Most of these tigers are in private hands. They are in private zoos. There are these people who use them for businesses, like cub petting, where they charge people to come pet them. They're just as many, you know, we don't even know.
My kids did that at a car dealership one time, I know.
Yes, that's right. And there are truck stops. They're all over the place. And the problem is that the U.S. government doesn't even know, not just the U.S. government, state governments don't know where they are. And they don't know what happens to them when they die. And so we don't know if they enter trade. They may not. They may do. And that's a big problem. And many, many countries besides China are starting to ask questions about, you know, what the hell is going on here. And it's fair game. So in answer to your question, there may be, you know, many, many more. I mean, some estimates say there are 15,000 running around the U.S. and nobody really knows, you know, who has them and for what purposes. But they breed like cats.
And part two. Let's keep the answers a little shorter. So
sorry.
We've got last couple of questions in before we have to break for lunch.
Sorry, I apologize. So tiger farms. I think that the best thing that could be done with tiger farms is to stop the breeding, to allow attrition to, you know, take the tigers down in number, and then to place as many as possible into zoos and other places where people can be educated about the needs of wild tigers.
Hi. Jeff Burnside from Como TV in Seattle. I'm glad Lori went last because I was just so angry listening to your facts, Judy. I just wanted to punch someone. You know, I mean, there are very few issues in journalism, and especially environmental journalism, where it's just where it's okay to take one side, because there's really only one side here, and it's saving these critters. It's the details, of course, of how you do that and where and why is what we need to write about. But I would hate to imagine that tigers and other great species would go extinct while we're all journalists, because it's kind of our watch. I just think that with some very wonderful exceptions, like your book, Sharon, we just haven't done enough. I mean, someone needs to pound on the table even more than we are now. What about the United Nations? I mean, I know that it seems like trade and money and sanctions and something. Can we think bigger? Is there something crazy outside the box that we need to be considering beyond trying to win? I don't know. It's just like we keep hearing this year in and year out, and yet the numbers keep declining. Your book has pointed out that some things do work, and Judy, you've said the same thing, but we need to ramp that up somehow. I mean, what if you had a magic wand here, what would you do?
The two hopeful things I've seen recently is the UK spearheaded an international meeting on the international wildlife trade, which is a $19 billion a year business. It's number four. It ranks four in illegal activities after human trafficking, drugs, and guns. So, you know, at least there is international attention, and that's a good thing. At the most recent CITES meeting, because Asian big cats, and particularly tigers, are in such bad shape, CITES voted to set up a working group that will be working year-round instead of just meeting once a year and talking for 5 minutes or half an hour about, you know, cat issues. So it'll be very interesting to see if anything comes out of that working group. Interestingly enough, China is chairing that group. So I'm not sure whether it's going to be fox in the hen house or it's just going to be so much attention paid that they're going to have to do something. Did you have anything to add?
I just wanted to add that from what I've seen, journalists aren't covering this issue much anymore. And everyone involved isn't asking the tough questions, and I don't understand why. And we're going to end up with a world with no tigers in it. And, you know, who's going to be accountable? I really appreciate your comments. And I agree.
I'm Isabel Abrams, freelance writer from Chicago. I recently read an article or heard it about children fighting the sale of elephant ivory in China. These kids were speaking up and they stopped selling them in the craft stores. And I know because I work with a group called Caretakers of the Environment International. These are high school students and teachers. And they can get attention where politicians or people employed by these government organizations or whatever have to keep silent. They can speak up, and there is a way, I think, a sideways way. And the other thing that, to communicate why we shouldn't be killing all the tigers, et cetera. And also, I wondered, since many of these things are drugs, sold as medications, if the drug companies wouldn't want to speak up about medications that would substitute for these supposed tiger potions and so on.
Well, to address that question, most of these, tiger bone remedies are not
being sold or manufactured anymore. So that's not really an issue. You know, what's really come out, and it actually headlined this last CITES meeting, is that it's wealth, not health, that's driving, you know, the trade in everything from rhinos, tigers, all of it. This is really now about, you know, wealth and privilege and flaunting one's wealth and influence, as Judy outlined. We have time for one last question. I'm so sorry we got pushed back, but we started late. And John?
Hi, John Platt, freelancer covering endangered species. Are the tigers that exist in these farms and in the exotic pet trade in the U.S. in any way of value to conservation, or are they most likely hybrids of multiple subspecies and therefore of little use in preserving the individual subspecies?
Do you want to start, or shall I? Probably, you know, I would think the large majority of them, you know, do not have clear bloodlines. Another thing is that the tiger farms in China treat their tigers horribly. They feed them chicken instead of meat. They end up with like all kinds of deformities because they haven't gotten proper nutrition. You know, like bent bodies, weird tails. I mean, it's like, they're treated horrifically. Many of them are skinny, emaciated, malnourished. You know, it's hard to, and who knows who bred with who. You know, these farms are a mix of species. I mean, anything from, you know, South China tigers to Siberian tigers to, you know, Bengals. I mean, everything. So there may be some place where they might be okay, but it'd be pretty tough to figure that out. So my not fully educated answer would be, I kind of doubt it. But
the State Forestry Administration of China will tell you that these tigers are being bred so they can be put out back in the wild. Firstly, there's no place to put them. And secondly, would you want them in their backyard, your backyard, when they've been getting food from humans? You know, humans equal food for them. And it's just, they don't have a role. And a lot of biologists view them as dead already because they have nothing to do with conservation of the wild, unfortunately.
Thank you so much for coming. And if you have further questions, please, you know, find any of us during the rest of the conference. Have a great afternoon. It's lunchtime. Let's head over.